It's Wednesday. We're halfway to the weekend, and this is the Commute Podcast, presented by National Office Systems, your local workspace experts. Whether you need a complete office makeover or simply some new furniture, National Office Systems is there to help. They are the exclusive local provider of DIRT modular interiors, manufactured right here in Savannah, as well as of Herman Miller Furniture. Improve your workplace experience today with National Office Systems. On today's commute, we recap the finale of the Georgia legislature, known as Sine Die, with regular op-ed contributor and public policy expert Kyle Wingfield. Also, we'll detail a rather unusual research project led by Georgia Southern grad student Lisa Powell that turned up some fascinating findings about Revolutionary War hero Casimir Pulaski. Welcome to The Commute. I'm Adam Van Brimmer, editorial page editor of the Savannah Morning News and SavannahNow.com. We produce this podcast every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday with an eye toward enlightening Savannians on the latest happenings here in town, along the coast, and throughout the state. Thank you for listening. Joining me now on The Commute is Kyle Wingfield, who writes a column for our paper once a week and is also the president and CEO of the Georgia Public Policy Foundation based in Atlanta. And Kyle, prior to taking his current position, was a political columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He tended to write the more conservative view for the AJC, but Kyle pretty much is a pretty pragmatic guy. That's why we love having him in our paper all the time, because he really takes complex issues and, for the most part, takes a lot of the partisanship out of it and does a good job of explaining them and presenting them. And Kyle was kind enough, because he has much more experience with the Georgia legislature than I do. I'm still a newbie, and while it was fun this year, I certainly bow to his expertise. And Kyle, where I'd like to start is with the leadership at Georgia Capitol this year. We have a new governor. We have a new lieutenant governor who is the head of the Senate. We have a House speaker who was somewhat under fire during the session. We had a lot of new committee chairmanships. What was, in your opinion, what kind of tone was there around the Capitol this year as compared to maybe recent years?
Well, thanks, Adam. And thanks for having me back on. It's great to be with you. I think the tone was really one of uncertainty, and that's natural when you have that kind of transition like you just outlined. It's natural in the first year of a new governor's term, much less when you have a new lieutenant governor in place. The House itself, by itself, replaced more than a dozen committee chairs.
Yeah.
Positions since last year, you know, through retirements and that sort of thing, and the Senate as well. So, and then the other factor was really, you know, the Democrats in Georgia are feeling a little feistier after last year's elections. They're speaking up more than maybe they have in the past and challenging legislation. So it was really one where you had the normal transition, a little bit more than that, a little bit more political uncertainty, you know, even going into next year than we've had recently in Georgia. And so I think people were still, even toward the end, trying to find their footing and know where things lay and how the various people in those various positions were going to act.
Yeah.
So I'd say uncertainty was really the watchword this year.
Do you think maybe that played a role in why some of the bigger pieces of legislation, whether it was voting machines or the state budget or even the abortion bill, passed early? It went to the governor before Sine Die, several days before Sine Die.
That probably was a factor. You know, anytime you have a really substantive bill like that, I think most people would agree that the preference is not to leave it till the last day. You know, certainly the budget, they never want to leave to the last day if they can avoid it. And, you know, a bill like the heartbeat bill, the anti-abortion bill, there were a lot of people who came to the Capitol to protest against and some for that bill. Mm-hmm. And so it creates a different sort of atmosphere in the building. And I think a lot of times the thinking is, okay, let's deal with that earlier than later if we can.
Right.
Because the chaos that is the last day, with so many measures still to be done, if you throw an X factor like a huge protest inside the building into that mix, it just it makes it all the more volatile. So there were still some people at the Capitol
yesterday,
last night, and walking around and protesting that bill. But you remember the crowds that there were when the measure was still in doubt.
Yeah.
And it was nothing like that.
Let's talk a little bit more about Governor Kemp. Obviously, he campaigned last year. He made a lot of promises on the campaign trail, and a lot of the things he pushed did get enacted this year. And some of the other things that he pushed didn't get enacted this year. But on the did side, we saw a fully funding of the public schools. We saw a school safety measure. We saw Medicaid waivers. We saw at least the teacher pay raise, at least, 60% of it passed. Of course, we mentioned the abortion bill. On the other side of the coin, the stuff that didn't advance included religious liberty legislation, maybe constitutional carry and gun control type issues, and then school choice. Is this how it usually plays out for first-term new governors? And how would you kind of score his legislative agenda for this year?
I expect they're feeling pretty good about this first year. You know, Governor Kemp is the first person to come in office without a revenue problem
in
quite some time, probably since Roy Barnes' first year in 1999, so 20 years ago.
Yeah, record budget, right? $26.5 million.
Yeah, $27.5 million, I think.
$27 billion.
What the final figure? Wow. Billion? Yes.
Yeah.
But you know, Sonny Perdue came in with a revenue shortfall. Nathan Deal obviously came in at a really low point economically and fiscally, so that gave him a little margin to work with, allowed him to go ahead and, you know, I think 60% of that teacher pay raise in year one is a very substantial down payment on that promise. Mm-hmm. Probably as much as could reasonably be expected in one fell swoop. The money for the school safety, fully funding QB, all those things, and a number of other initiatives. I think getting to having the money to where you can do those things really helps you get off to a good start. For my money, the most consequential thing, I think, that will come out of this session is the healthcare waivers legislation, Medicaid, and also the private side of the market, the Affordable Care Act exchanges, mm-hmm. Being able to go to Washington and ask for the flexibility to manage those a little bit differently, arrange the subsidies a little bit differently, allow more choice and competition of what sorts of plans can be on the exchange and are eligible for subsidies. All of that has the potential to really be transformative in a market that obviously affects a whole lot of Georgians. So I think that'll be one of the big ones. And then another,
Hold on, Kyle. Let's stay right there for a second. So obviously the Patients First Act gives Governor Kemp and his team the ability to really explore these things and figure out what they want to do. Next year, when we come back for the session, what has to happen legislatively to take these ideas and make them reality?
Well, the only thing would be probably budgetary.
Okay.
If there's a budget component for the state, obviously on Medicaid, And there's some back and forth about what the match rate from the feds will be. And there's some back and forth with among the feds as to what the match rate may be, whether it's 90% or more like 2/3. You know, either way, the state would have to put some money forward if there are new people added to Medicaid. If some of what they do in the private market side involves, say, a reinsurance program to kind of cover the costliest patients out there, you know, the state could have to kick in some money to make that work. So, but from an authority standpoint, really, I don't think anything that can be done within the executive branch, he's not going to have to get approval for it. It'll really be a budgetary thing.
So that won't become a big, because next year is a campaign year, right? An election year. So that won't really become a hot potato, something that the parties can squabble over come next March.
Well, it depends. Within the session next year, probably not. And again, we're kind of forecasting or speculating about what the governor is going to ask for in the way of flexibility and what the federal government is going to grant in the way of flexibility. But I think when you talk about next year's election, Mm-hmm. Again, depending on what comes out of it, you may well have Democrats who say, look, this was not the right way to go. We should have just expanded Medicaid. So I think it's probably more of an electoral fight next year than a legislative one.
Okay.
If there is a fight.
Very interesting. I think the other issue for you were probably going to touch on involved education. Of course, school choice has been a big issue in recent years at the legislature. And this year is, last year was the first year where we fully funded the public schools. And I think that a lot of people agree that was probably something that had to happen before we had any more real discussion about school choice. They went ahead and did that again this year. A lot of the school choice measures that were introduced this year, of course, can come back next year. They are still alive. They don't have to be reintroduced. What do you think the efforts on the education side are going to mean in terms of next year and going forward?
Well, I think it's certainly an easier conversation to have when you're not talking about austerity cuts, you know, to the school funding formula. So, I think, like you said, having that a second year in a row, you know, assuming revenues don't take a dip, next year you would be talking about a third year in a row of that. And on top of that are the teacher raises, the school safety funding, which was about $69 million this year,
and
some other things out there. So you're really talking about overall spending on education going up by even more than the funding formula would suggest. So I think in that context, you know, I'm sure those of us who support a measure like an education scholarship account are going to be thinking through, you know, what it would take to make that idea more appealing to people and help people realize that it's not a zero sum game, that you can support public schools in this state and support choices for parents and families and students at the same time.
Another big topic at the State House this year seemed to be local control versus state control. We saw it yesterday with the whole discussion of a takeover of the Atlanta airport, which eventually morphed into oversight of Atlanta and all the other commercial airports in the state. It ultimately failed. It didn't pass. So it's not necessarily an issue at this point. And then, of course, we had the Monuments Act that passed that basically tightened the state regulations on what a local municipality can do with monuments in their area. Of course, before crossover day, we talked about some building code standards that the state was going to put in. What is behind the whole tussle between the state and the local authorities in terms of governing?
Well, I think some of this is natural and goes on pretty much all the time. I've often been a little cynical about the local control argument. I find it is most often championed by those who are losing a debate, and it's a position they fall back onto. Which is not to suggest they don't believe it. I just think it's sort of a, you know, not
it's
exactly
a trump card. Business, it's the one in the hole.
Exactly. Huh. It's the ace in the hole sometimes. And I think it depends too on what the issue is. You know, like the building ordinances, measure, you know, we as a foundation, we looked at that and said, yes, local control is important, but we're really talking about private property rights. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes a matter of which level of government is going to take the lead in protecting and preserving private property rights. Little different, obviously, with something like a public monument in a public space and where a local government can place that. And I think here again, I don't know that issue is really local control versus state control so much as, you know, whether you think, monuments to the Confederacy, and I know it applies to more than that, but ought to be, you know, whether a local community ought to be the one to decide whether it's time to remove one of those or not. So, I think the local control thing is an element, but usually when that's invoked, it's because there's something else going on that is a different kind of debate.
I want to wrap up with one issue that really kind of died on crossover day, and that was gambling in the state of Georgia and which direction we were going. Of course, we have a local representative here, Ron Stevens, who has championed casino gambling for a couple of years now. And then we had another local representative this year who floated some legislation that involved sports gambling. And then, of course, we had some folks in the other part of the state that were pushing for horse racing. Now, ultimately, none of these got any real traction. None of them passed. What we did have yesterday, though, was the establishment of a commission to study gambling. And I can assume that they're going to be looking at what the money could go toward, which, of course, people say should be Hope Scholarship or pre-K or the like. And I'm just kind of curious, as you're familiar with these commissions and study committees and things that get set up all the time, what are we going to see in the next 7, 8, 9 months leading into the next session in terms of getting prepared for the gambling discussion?
Well, I generally think there are three kinds of study committees. There's the kind that is established to justify what the legislative leaders know they already want to do. There's the kind that's set up to justify not taking action on something they know they don't want to do, so it's a way of punting. And then there's the third kind, which is they genuinely aren't quite sure which course to take, and so they set it up. From where I'm sitting, it seems a little too early to say which type this one is. They have studied casino and horse racing gambling in the past under the auspices of looking for new revenue for the Hope Scholarship. So it's not as if this is the first time they're doing it. It would make sense if you were going to try to put a referendum on the ballot. You wouldn't do it until the election year itself, because, right, you know, putting it on, if they had approved it this year for next year, mm-hmm, you give opponents of the measure an extra year to spin up their campaign to fight it. So not surprised that they wouldn't do it this year, but a little too early from where I sit to say, you know, whether that's a precursor to seeing it next year or whether, you know, ultimately they'll just punt on it again.
Right. Well, certainly give us something to keep us preoccupied in the long season between legislative sessions. Kyle, thanks very much for coming on. We enjoy having your work in the paper and online, and I always appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
Always my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Kyle resides in Atlanta, but if he lived here on the coast, he'd certainly be a Freedom Boat Club member. Well, Freedom Boat Club, you buy a membership and their boats become your boats without the cleaning, maintenance, insurance, storage, and other hassles and headaches that come with ownership. The Freedom Boat Club has two local locations, one in Thunderbolt and the other in Richmond Hill. Contact Freedom Steve Sherman now at 912-226-2617 or visit freedomboatclub.com and complete the information request form. Mention this podcast and receive a free hat and t-shirt combo just for showing interest. Again, that phone number is 912-226-2617, and the website is freedomboatclub.com. Freedom Boat Club, get on the water today. Our second guest on this Wednesday edition is Georgia Southern grad student Lisa Powell. She's a Savannian, and many decades ago, her father put together a research team that sought to determine if celebrated local Revolutionary War hero, Casimir Pulaski, was indeed entombed in the downtown square that bears his statue. The team found remains, but the discovery came with a twist. The bones appeared to belong to a female. DNA testing was very rudimentary at the time, so the team had to abandon the project without an answer to the mystery. Fast forward to today, and his daughter Lisa has picked back up the project. She and her team did find answers, and they are so startling that the Smithsonian Channel built a documentary around them. The piece, entitled America's Hidden Stories, The General Was Female, will premiere at 8 p.m. Monday on the Smithsonian Channel. But Savannians can get a sneak peek tonight in a preview screening at the Georgia Southern Armstrong campus. The screening starts at 7 p.m. in the Geechee Theater in the Student Union. Lisa Powell joins me now. Lisa, thanks. First of all, thank you for joining me. Second of all, so setting this up is a little bit difficult because it's kind of a strange saga, a strange story. Can you kind of talk about solving this Casimir Pulaski mystery?
Sure. So the project actually started about 23 years ago in March. Mm-hmm. And the project was started. Don Gardner, that used to work for Parks and Trees in Savannah, had asked Dr. James Metz Jr. And my dad, Chuck Powell, to form a team because they were redoing the monument, the Pulaski Monument downtown. And they thought that there might be a body inside the monument, but they weren't sure. But they wanted to be ready just in case. So Dad and Dr. Mann assembled their team. They did actually find a body in the monument. And once they laid the body out for inspection, they noticed that the pelvis was female.
Right.
And so Dr. Burns was like, "Jimmy, you're going to have to shoot me. I think it's a female skeleton." And Dr. Metz was like, "Well, hold on." He went to lunch and came back with a picture of a condition called congenital adrenal hypoplasia. And the picture looked almost exactly like a portrait of Casimir Pulaski, even though, you know, the portrait was from the 1700s and this picture from the medical dictionary was from like 1965. The similarity was amazing. And so he said, "You still have a job to do. Do your job." So they took the historical evidence that they had on Casimir Pulaski and certain injuries in his life that he received during battle and other things, and they were able to match those wounds to the body. So that just increased the mystery. You know, this why would a female skeleton be married in a monument, be buried in a monument with all these, you know, war wounds that match the wounds that we know historically Casimir Pulaski received? So it was very intriguing. And of course, for, you know, the better part of a couple hundred years, there's been this mystery. Was Casimir Pulaski buried at sea? Was Casimir Pulaski buried at Greenwich Plantation and then therefore put in the monument? And we knew eventually the only way to put that myth to rest permanently would be to have DNA evidence.
Yeah.
Because, you know, without that, people are going to always say, "Well, you know, it could have just been a woman that, you know, led a hard life, or, you know, maybe they had these same injuries." There's going to always be a reason that it couldn't be Casimir Pulaski without DNA proof. So the original team traveled to Poland, where the genealogist and her her cohort in Poland actually were able to track down a female relative of Casimir Pulaski, a great niece named Michalska. And once they did that, they were able to extract some material, some skeletal remains from that grave. And so we had that, and we had some of the remains from the monument that we kept. And at that point, they started trying to do DNA. Now, both of these samples were extremely old and extremely degraded. And so that was a challenge. And especially back then, you know, 20 years ago to even 10 years ago, DNA was not what it is now. So right before Carr passed away, she was getting ready to send some new samples off to a new DNA lab that supposedly had luck with ancient DNA. And when she passed away, everything kind of came to a screeching halt. And so it kind of sat around for years. And, you know, my team joined in about 4 or 5 years ago. My dad was like, I was house sitting for him at Tybee. And he's like, "Don't mind all those boxes in there. It's just the Pulaski stuff, you know." And he said, "I'm just done with it. I'm going to retire the project because we're never going to have an answer." And I was just like, "Dad, what do you think I'm doing with my life?"
Right. Right.
"I'm studying archaeology and anthropology. This is what I want to do." And he said, "But you're not there yet." But I like, I know people.
That's right.
And he's like, "You really think you could get a team together?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I do think that." And he said, "Okay, I'll give you a shot at it." So I assembled a new team with myself and Dr. Virginia Estabrook. I also made it a point to try and contact, and also through my dad, as many members of the original team or committee as possible to invite them to participate in this as well, since they were the ones that started this project so long ago. I felt like there was more than enough in this case that, you know, everybody should be included.
Right.
And we also brought in another forensic anthropologist, Dr. Megan Moore, from University of East Michigan. And so the rest of this team has brought it forward in conjunction with the old team. And we sent DNA samples off to an ancient DNA lab that had extreme luck with collecting DNA from really, really degraded remains. And they were able to match the mitochondria. CNA, and we were all just ecstatic.
Wow. Yeah.
So, I mean, what are the odds that these two would be a match when you have one that is skeletal manes that appear to be female biologically in a monument in Savannah, Georgia, and you have, you know, grave remains from, you know, a female great niece of Pulaski's all the way in Poland. And mm-hmm. the fact that these two samples matched mitochondrially is just amazing. So it's Casimir Pulaski.
Pulaski is female.
Well, that okay, let's say this. I mean, there's a question mark after that in that title. Okay. You know, the general is female question mark. Yes, it is Casimir Pulaski. But Casimir Pulaski was born and baptized a male.
Right.
Baptized Casimir Pulaski. So a lot of people, we would consider this an intersex condition. In other words, we don't really know how this condition affected his body. But what we do know is that his parents thought that it was not ambiguous enough not to baptize him male.
Sure.
Raise him male. He was raised in the saddle, was the father of American cavalry, was a brave and gregarious leader.
Where does the documentary come in? Was the Smithsonian or whoever produced this, made this for the Smithsonian, part of your team, or how did that all get tied together?
So it turned out one of my professors, Dr. Tatlock at Armstrong, this was formerly, you know, Georgia Southern, but when it was Armstrong, had done a documentary with the History Channel. So I asked him if he could do an introduction to me with that person, who just so happened to be Tim Evans. And Tim and I hit it off really well, and I told him the story. And he challenged me a lot at first, you know, like, who is this Casimir Pulaski and why should we care? And I got really passionate about it and kind of like laid it out. And he's like, okay, I was just testing you to see how passionate you were about this.
Yeah.
And he said, I can tell that this is a very important story to you, but I have a confession to make. I no longer work for the History Channel. Mm-hmm. However, I am the executive producer of Smithsonian Channel, and I would love to produce your documentary.
So the documentary airs Monday night, but you're having an event tonight where you're going to preview it. Can you talk about that event and what else is going on other than just the screening of the documentary?
The actual event will start from 7 to 8, and the screening lasts right about 51 minutes, and it'll be followed by a Q&A session with myself, my father, who is a local historian and was the project coordinator for the original team of the project. And then also Dr. Virginia Estabrook, my mentor, and a forensic anthropologist. And so we will do Q&A. Tim Evans, the executive producer of Smithsonian, is going to moderate the Q&A, which is really nice that they want to be this involved.
So your father, when obviously he was ready to shelve it, didn't envision that it was ever going to come to any kind of conclusion. What was his reaction as this went through and when you finally got the word that, hey, Casimir Pulaski did have an intersex condition. What was he? Obviously, he was probably pretty excited, right?
He was super excited. And it was kind of a mission for me to try and get him an answer. And I wanted him to be a part of this. You know, as we took this project forward, I wanted him to be a part of it. And I think at the very beginning, he was a little bit hesitant and a little bit resistant because he just wasn't sure that I was going to be able to get a team together to pull it off. But I think as he realized that, you know, like I said, serendipitously, everything seemed to be falling into place. It's like, this is the right time, and it's now, and all these things started happening, and it didn't take him long to fall in, and he was super excited about it. He really loved being a part of the process, you know, having input in everything, having a say in how things were done and how things were worded and things like that. It was very important to him. And it's always been important to him to note that this is a team effort. The newer team, you know, was able to bring it to its fruition with help from Smithsonian, but we would have never gotten where we were without the original, you know, 20 years of the original team and all the work they put into this project before we jumped on board.
Thank you very much for joining me, Lisa. That will wrap up the Wednesday edition of The Commute. Let me thank our guests, Savannah Morning News op-ed contributor and the head of the Georgia Public Policy Foundation, Kyle Wingfield, as well as Georgia Southern's Lisa Powell. Also our sponsors, National Office Systems and Freedom Boat Club. Please support them as they support this podcast. You have been listening to The Afternoon Commute. We'll talk to you Friday.